Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Welcome to EIR Talks. It's Monday, December 17, 2001, and this is Tony Papert. The collapse of Enron Corporation over the past weeks was no surprise to anybody who had been listening to Lyndon LaRouche. Since the beginning of this year, the LaRouche presidential campaign had placed major emphasis on exposing the hoax of energy deregulation, the disasters that had to result from it, and the fraud of the deregulation energy pirate corporations led by Enron Corporation. Not only did the LaRouche campaign fight this across the United States, but crossed the border into Mexico and led a binational campaign against energy deregulation. The LaRouche campaign led the opposition to dereg, which produced the congressional hearings into energy deregulation this summer and the first tentative steps toward re-regulation, which began in California and nationally at about the same time. Add the impact of the accelerating economic downturn and the September 11th attack, and the most extreme deregulators like Enron Corporation, which had placed all their bets on continuing of deregulation of energy and all public utilities across the United States, these energy pirates began to fall into trouble, and their friends among the Wall Street sharks moved in to finish them off. This is what LaRouche West Coast spokesman Harley Schlanger called in a recent EIR article the LaRouche factor in Enron's collapse. In a moment, we'll see EIR contributing editor Jeff Steinberg interview Harley Schlanger on the LaRouche factor in the Enron collapse. Following that, Jeff will interview EIR economics writer John Hoeffel on the truth behind the fraud of the energy pirate corporations.
My name is Jeff Steinberg. I'm a senior editor with Executive Intelligence Review magazine, and I'm pleased to be talking now via phone hookup with Harley Schlanger, who is the Western States coordinator of the LaRouche in 2004 presidential campaign. Harley Schlanger was also the author of a December 7th article, which appeared in Executive Intelligence Review magazine, called The LaRouche Factor in the Enron Demise. Harley, welcome to the LaRouche Connection.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Fine, thanks. I'd like to ask you, for starters, in your article that appeared recently in the Executive Intelligence Review magazine, you discussed the Southern strategy and the significance of that in the context of the demise of Enron. Could you please explain to our viewers what you mean by the Southern strategy?
Well, the idea of the Southern Strategy was launched in the middle 1960s to the late 1960s by Richard Nixon. And the key to it in terms of the energy fight and these other fights we're talking about today is the idea of the promotion of the attack on the federal government, the attack on the regulatory powers of government, and the idea that power should go back to the states or even more importantly to the markets and the private sector. And this was pushed essentially in the most recent period after the Republican victory in 1994, the so-called Gingrich Revolution, where you had most of the positions in the House and Senate of power going to Republicans from the South, including the dirty trio from Texas, Dick Armey, Phil Graham, and Tom DeLay. And they promoted the idea that less government will lead to more efficiency. It will lead to a deregulated market, will improve competition and therefore lower prices. And that was what was sold state by state in the early 1990s on the question of electricity deregulation. But in fact, if you look back at this, this is something that Lyndon LaRouche started going after back at the time of the Carter administration, when we first had a Democrat who was part of the Southern Strategy, with the deregulation of the airline industry, the trucking industry, and then in the early 1980s, banking, to the point that today, virtually the whole U.S. economy is deregulated, And that's the background for the collapse of Enron. And that's what we mean when we refer to the Southern strategy.
Prior to the events of September 11th, if you had spoken to a large number of Americans and asked them what they look back on as one of the most important political events of the year 2001, probably a lot of people would talk about the fight in California, the energy crisis that began last winter and carried into the beginning of this year. In your article, you spoke at some length about that California showdown between Enron and the state officials in California. Maybe you could elaborate a bit on that issue.
Well, it's something that's definitely worth looking at, in that here you have the wealthiest state and supposedly the wealthiest nation in the world, and as we were going into the beginning of the year 2001, there was a real question as to whether or not the lights would be able to be kept on during the winter and then in the summer. Now, the crisis in California actually began in June and July of 2000 when deregulation first kicked in. And it's worth noting, Jeff, that deregulation in California passed the legislature unanimously, not a single vote against it from Democrats or Republicans. And it began in the first part of 2000, and it was phased in the San Diego area. As soon as it started, the prices of electricity went up 400%. And this led to a severe crisis, a political eruption from San Diego, which was an indication of what would be coming when the rest of the state would be brought in, the other two major utilities in the state beginning in 2001. Now, the key to it, to understand it, is that under a regulated electricity generating system, where you had the utility companies both producing the energy and then delivering it, for a number of years, we had a stable price at around $35 per megawatt hour. But once deregulation hit, and the price depended on the speculation of natural gas, as well as just the trading market, such as Enron and others, could jack the price up depending on demand, the price tended to average between $300 and $400 a megawatt hour, so from $35 to $300 to $400, with spikes of $1,700 to as much as $3,900 a megawatt hour. And this is what triggered the initial fight in California.
Now, you said, and it's really quite shocking, that the whole deregulation push in California was a bipartisan, unanimous phenomenon. What were the factors that prompted the fight? Obviously, at a certain point, Governor Davis and others in California became aware that this was disastrous and began fighting back, particularly against Enron and some of the other big energy speculators. Does this get us into the LaRouche factor, which was the main subject of your article?
Sure, because what happened is initially the governor was hit with a problem, which is that Pacific Gas and Electric, which is the second largest utility company in California, went into bankruptcy because they could not afford the high rates of electricity that Enron and Dynegy and Calpines and Williams and others were charging. And so the state moved in to take over the purchase of electricity. Now, initially, the state tried to solve this by attempting to negotiate long-term contracts at a locked-in price. Now, we first got involved in the middle of January 2001, just as it was starting. I brought in Senator Joe Neal, State Senator Joe Neal from Nevada, came with me to Sacramento, and we met with some of the aides to the governor. In fact, we had a meeting in San Francisco. The night we had the meeting there, the town meeting, there was a blackout in San Francisco, fortunately not at our hotel. So Senator Neal and I met with some of the top aides to the governor, and they were asking him for his advice because he'd been leading the fight against deregulation in Nevada. And what he said is, look, the most important thing is you have to re-regulate. Then they asked me what Mr. LaRouche thought, and I said, well, re-regulation is a start, but we need to fight for a whole new monetary system. At that point, they turned back to Senator Neal and said, all right, so how do we re-regulate? What was clear to me is that they were not prepared for the fight, that they were trying to make deregulation work. And so what happened is that the state started paying more and more money. The other large utility, Southern California Edison, hovered toward bankruptcy. And at a certain point, it became clear that the state was going to be the buyer of electricity for the people of California. There were several rate hikes, but essentially the state went from a net surplus to having to spend close to $30 billion during the year 2001, which effectively prevented blackouts from occurring, but it nearly bankrupted the state. So we were there from the beginning, telling them you have to deregulate or re-regulate rather. We had teams of young people who have joined the LaRouche campaign from college campuses all over the state go with us to Sacramento. We met with legislators. We met with aides to the governor. We had town meetings throughout the state. And then on top of this, Lyndon LaRouche in early February released a pamphlet on how to address both the short-term, the medium-term, and the long-term needs of electricity. This was a pamphlet, The California Energy Crisis as Seen and Heard from the Salton Sea, where he had delivered a major policy address. So this was distributed in the hundreds of thousands, probably a couple million of these pamphlets in California and in the West. And so that's how the fight was launched. Now, the other point we kept making to the governor and his aides is that you have to name the names. It's not just a product of a market. The market is rigged. It's probably illegal what companies like Enron were doing. And again, at first, they were afraid to bring that up. But finally, around the middle to the end of January, the governor of California finally started talking about what he called the energy pirates of Houston. And so it was our insistence on bringing up both the question of re-regulation, which they're still afraid to touch, but then naming the names of the people who were looting the state, which forced a change in policy. That is, the companies that were doing it were now so publicly exposed that they started rigging the markets downward a little bit to take some of the heat off them.
Harley, I believe you also did some traveling down to Mexico and other parts of the United States to make this fight broader than just simply a California issue. How did that work?
Well, in fact, one of the first places I went was to Nevada with Senator Neal. And Senator Neal's work in the Nevada State Senate caused a resolution to be passed which stopped deregulation in Nevada. We had meetings I was in Albuquerque, Denver. And then the Mexico trip was interesting because Mr. LaRouche said that this would be a way of coming up with, in a sense, a southern flank against Enron. Because the whole fight in Mexico is that there are huge gas and oil reserves in Mexico that the U.S. companies have their eyes on. But Mexico has a regulated system. It's got a national system of electricity production, and Pemex is the national oil and gas company. So Enron and others started coming into Mexico to offer money, to offer investment, saying that they'd like to be involved in Mexico. So we went in, and I gave a whole series of lectures before economists, engineering associations, and also a presentation, a forum held in the Mexican National Congress, as well as in the State Congress in Guanajuato, which is the home state of President Fox, where we exposed to them what actually happened in California. And this caused a huge scandal in Mexico. It was front page news in Excelsior, in Milenio, Diario, some of the leading newspapers, as well as television and radio coverage. So this was, in a sense, a way that we generated an additional flank. And in Mexico, they started talking about Enron and others as los cuates de Bush, that is, the close cronies of Bush, given Enron's role during that time, not only as a looting operation, but Kenneth Lay, the CEO of Enron, was President Bush's energy advisor.
Of course, it seems that in the recent period those friendships didn't run all that deep, and that the Bush administration at this point certainly has been glaringly missing from the scene in the sense of stepping in to bail out Enron. Is it your evaluation that enough of a setback was delivered to deregulation as a policy that the demise of Enron sort of followed as the consequence of that?
I think it's two things, Jeff. I think one is the incredible excesses and the arrogance of the people of Enron who said now that it's deregulated, We make the rules. We control the game. Nobody can tell us what to do. Their CEO, who the man who replaced Ken Lay in February, Jeffrey Skilling, who by April was called the second most powerful CEO in the country by Worth Magazine, a magazine very familiar to us because of the involvement in Worth Magazine and the Get LaRouche Task Force in the past. They were promoting Enron as a great company, as the company of the future. And a few months after that, Skilling resigned in disgrace and Enron collapsed. So I think partly it was the arrogance, but more importantly, it's the fact that all of this is occurring in a financial breakdown. And you can't lose sight of that. That part of the deal that behind deregulation is that if you get government out, that as the economy is collapsing, these companies can loot and loot and loot, including looting each other. I think at a certain point, the banks and the other energy companies figured that they let Enron go as a scapegoat. And I'm sure if Ken Lay thought he had President Bush's cell phone number, he soon found that the president probably had call screening on it and wasn't letting his calls through.
You ended your EIR piece of December 7th by discussing the fact that this fight really can't be won simply on the basis of bringing an end to deregulation, that we've reached a point where something much more fundamental along the lines of Mr. LaRouche's overall policies is urgently required. This idea of putting these companies through bankruptcy reorganization seems to be a piece of that, but maybe you could close out this interview by elaborating on the broader policy issues that are going to have to be addressed before this particular crisis can be fully solved.
Well, as I mentioned in LaRouche's pamphlet on the California energy crisis, he identified the immediate term, which is to immediately re-regulate and immediately proceed through bankruptcy reorganization to make sure there's adequate electricity with the existing grid. But under the longer term needs, if we intend to rebuild the U.S. economy, which of course we should do, and LaRouche has elaborated an extensive plan for that, it's going to require more energy. And it means, among other things, that we're going to need to reorganize the credit system in the United States and globally, which requires a new Bretton Woods. It also means we're going to have massive investments in research and development in new energy technologies, such as nuclear fusion. So I think in that pamphlet, anyone who's serious about energy policy has to pick up LaRouche's policy pamphlet and study it and look at both the short-term and the long-term necessities. And you can't do that without recognizing that what knocked the whole system out of whack is the 30-year degeneration of the physical economy of this country under the direction of the policies of the Southern Strategy.
Harley, how many copies of that pamphlet were circulated in California and nationally? You have a rough idea?
I think we printed 2 to 3 million nationally, and I think we may have gotten out almost 1 million of those in California. I know there was a time where if you walked into the legislature or you walked into many of the economics departments of major universities with a pamphlet, people would say, oh, we've already seen that. So I know we had a certain kind of saturation, especially in the Los Angeles and San Francisco area. But I would add that that we still have some today, and it's a pamphlet that's highly relevant for the policy debates that should take place over the months ahead. So the viewers should feel free to call in and pick up copies of it.
Harley, thanks a lot for your time, and I'm sure this is a story that we'll be wanting to discuss again in the near future.
Well, my pleasure, Jeff.
Okay. In fact, if any of our audience would like to receive a free copy of that LaRouche pamphlet on the subject of a long-term energy policy to deal with the crisis provoked by the deregulation mania of the last 30 years, you can call the toll-free number 888-347-3258, and we will send a copy of that pamphlet out to you immediately. For the LaRouche Connection, this is Jeff Steinberg.
Now we'll see a recent interview of John Hoeffel, EIR economics writer, by Jeff Steinberg, on the truth behind Enron.
I'm Jeff Steinberg. I'm here in the studio today with John Hoeffel, who is a senior economic analyst with Executive Intelligence Review magazine. John had been tracking Enron from its very early days back in the mid-1980s and has been writing extensively on the meteoric rise and even more rapid collapse of Enron. So it's a delight to have you in the studio today, John, to talk a bit about the fall of the House of Enron.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to discuss this subject.
I gather from the look on your face that you're not exactly an impartial observer.
No. We've been doing our part to see that they went under.
We spoke yesterday with Harley Schlanger, who's the West Coast coordinator of the LaRouche in 2004 campaign, and he told us about the fight in California that you were directly involved in. I believe you made one of those trips to Mexico and were making recommendations that deregulation is not here to stay, and that this whole deregulation system is bringing about crises way beyond anything the authors of it imagined.
That's true. I mean, the first thing you have to understand about deregulation is that it is an absolute and total fraud. That the intent of deregulation has never been to lower energy prices, to lower electricity prices, to give the consumers freedom to choose, none of that. What it has been from the very beginning is an attempt by the financial oligarchy, the banks and big investment banks and others, to stick their hand in your pocket and grab a chunk of the income stream that you pay for your electricity. They want a piece of your electric bill. And that is the short term. And in the long term, what it is it's a post-crash maneuver to allow them, after all of this hundreds of trillions of dollars of financial paper disappears, that what they'll be left with is this income stream, that if you want to have lights, if you want to heat your house, that sort of thing, that they get a cut.
Okay, now, under the old system, under the traditional, tried and tested, regulated system, there were utility companies. They tended to be the producers of the electricity. They owned the generators. They had a relationship, ownership over the power lines. Prices tended to be more or less regulated within a kind of a limited price band, I guess. So now we've got this deregulated system, and there's all sorts of newfangled terms that I frankly don't understand. Maybe you could help me out here. What is a virtual energy company? I understand Enron was the pioneer of this idea of virtual energy companies.
Well, a virtual energy company is like these energy pirates, as we call them, as California Governor Gray Davis has called them, are companies that, even though they may have some energy-producing assets, essentially what they're in the business of doing is buying and selling electricity. They're traders. They're the equivalent of a Wall Street investment bank, buying and selling currencies and bonds and things like that, only they do this in the realm of energy. And the largest of these companies was Enron, which was created by merger in 1985. And from all I can tell, I think it was created for the purpose of becoming one of the pioneers of energy deregulation. In 1989, Enron became one of the first companies to go into England, where deregulation was born. And they learned the ropes there. The British taught them how it works. And then they came back into the United States and started, with the money that they made from deregulation, lobbying and God knows what else, to get deregulation pushed. And so Enron transformed itself from a pipeline company into the world's largest energy trader, that they would buy it where it was cheap and sell it where they could get the most amount of money for it. And that, of course, buying cheap and selling dear, all in order to have everybody have a lower electric bill.
Absolutely.
Yes. They're looking out for the little guy.
Talk about California in terms of what the actual consequences were of this experiment in deregulation.
Well, it blew out California. In 1999, the electric bill for California was $7 billion. In 2000, it was $28 billion. And that was also the year that Enron stock shot through the roof. Enron had a very good year. In 99 and into 2000, the energy companies, the energy pirates, cleaned up in California because they held the state hostage. And they bid up the price of power. They manipulated the supply. They did everything that they could do to prove that deregulation is an absolute failure. And it was. And as they got so greedy in California that basically the whole thing blew up.
Now, what pulled the plug on Enron? Give our listeners a chronology of when this thing started to really go down the tubes. Obviously, this was not a phenomenon that started with September 11th or anything related to those events.
No, Enron had been falling since its peak in about August of 2000. Its stock had begun to deteriorate as it became obvious that the problem with these companies is that they're not viable businesses. Energy piracy is not a viable business. It's any more than cannibalism is a long-term economic strategy. Mm-hmm. No, they're not producing anything, they're looting. And you've got this giant pyramid scheme is effective what it is in an environment in which the global economy is collapsing. And it became obvious that the Enrons of this world could not survive. Now, they played all kinds of accounting games to try to make it look like they were solid. But they never were. It was never a viable, once it got away from its roots as a pipeline company, it was never a viable company. It was an accounting trick.
The news coverage, even at the early phases of the collapse of Enron, talked about Enron as the LTCM of 2001. I think there was a story in the London Economist and the Wall Street Journal. The financial press began sending out early warning signals. Obviously, that also helped to accelerate the dumping of Enron stock. But why would an energy company, even a virtual energy company, be engaged in the kinds of large-scale derivatives transactions, which was the essence of LTCM and why it jeopardized the entire international financial system when it teetered on the edge of bankruptcy? What's the Enron derivatives connection here?
Well, Enron was not an energy company, not even a virtual energy company. Enron was an investment bank. In its filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission, it identified itself as an investment bank using the same classification used by Goldman Sachs.
Huh.
No. They made no pretense about being an energy company. They just speculated. They were a financial play in the energy markets, as all of these pirates are. They're financial plays. They're not energy companies. And Enron was one of the leaders, probably the leader in the whole field of energy derivatives and opening up all sorts of other commodities. You know, Enron, they lobbied heavily with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to have over-the-counter derivatives exempted from the CFTC regulation. And the commissioner who pushed that was Wendy Graham, the wife of Senator Phil Graham. When she left the CFTC, Wendy Graham joined Enron's board.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Enron has held a position on the board of the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, which is the major over-the-counter derivatives trade group. They have lobbied Congress. They have testified before Congress on derivatives matters. They are a major force in the derivatives world. They're not an energy company. They're a casino player.
You mentioned Wendy Graham, and I think it's pertinent that two prominent members of the Texas Republican congressional delegation, Wendy Graham's husband, Phil Graham, and just a few days ago, the House Majority Leader, Dick Armey, both announced that they were leaving the Congress. In the case of Dick Armey, it was kind of on short notice, and John McCain, the senator from Arizona, made a kind of a side comment the other day on the floor of the Senate, suggesting there may be some linkage here between the fall of Enron and the fall of these two very prominent and powerful members of Congress. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know what goes on in the mind of a Phil Graham or a Dick Armey.
That's good. That's healthy that you don't.
Yeah, if I did, it would probably cause damage. But I think that it's clearly the case of rats leaving a sinking ship. I mean, in the case of Graham, he left in early September. He left before the World Trade Center events, before the collapse of Enron. But he knew Enron was coming. I mean, there are other aspects to this, I think, but certainly in the case of Enron, since he was on the banking committee, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, and his wife was a board member of Enron, he knew what was coming. You know, Jeff Skilling, the president of Enron, stepped down in August. So this has been known that trouble was coming for quite a while. In the case of Dick Armey, Enron gave him a lot of money. There are probably scandals there. And then overall,
Armey's chief of staff came to his office from Enron, and shortly before Armey announced he was leaving the Congress, this staff guy announced he was going back, I think, to Enron or perhaps somewhere else back in the private sector. So
Enron has always functioned as a kind of a way station for out of work,
in and out of government.
Well, I was going to say out of work Bush League officials, but scoundrels works just as well.
Well, actually, you raised the Bush League question. 6-8 months ago, Enron was synonymous with George W. Bush, and it's pretty noteworthy that since the summer, there's been a kind of a trap door that's been slammed down, separating even Ken Lay, who was being earlier mooted to be the Secretary of Treasury in the Bush administration, from the White House and from President Bush. Is this another case of friendships fading fast when the criminality starts becoming publicly known?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a case of the Bush administration making the political decision that they didn't want to go down with Enron, that they didn't want to get tarred by what will, as these investigations, the congressional hearings, depending upon how these congressional hearings are used, the SEC investigations and the Justice Department investigations come out, I think you'll discover that Enron was very dirty, played a lot of, and probably there were a lot of monies passing under the table and things like that. And I think that the decision was made from the Bush administration, we can't touch this. We can't have anything to do with this. This is just too dirty.
Now, after September 11th, particularly because it was a further factor accelerating the rate of collapse of the real economy, has this put this derivatives, or really the deregulation policy issue, in somewhat different light? After all, we've now committed to have to deal with the various fronts in this war on terrorism in response to September 11th. The economy is more fragile than it was before September 11th, and it was already in the throes of a real depression, they say in the media, recession. But you've been writing for quite some time, exposure material in EIR, about the real scope and depth of the actual financial, monetary, and economic collapse. Do you see in the collapse of Enron a kind of a signal event that would indicate that this whole process of radical deregulation has reached the end of the rope?
Yes, I do. I think that, to begin with, what Enron got caught up in was a deflationary death spiral. That the more bad news that came out, and it was also under attack by the Wall Street Journal and others, but the more bad news came out, the more that was revealed about how it actually operated or didn't operate, as the case may be, the faster its stock sank. It evaporated. This $60 billion corporation evaporated in a matter of weeks. And that is actually a metaphor for what's going on with the global financial system, that you have a rapid deflation of financial assets. All sorts of paper is just losing its value all around the world. At the same time, you have this attempt by Greenspan and others to flood the market with money. So you have a hyperinflationary monetary policy fighting to overcome a deflationary collapse of asset values, and the monetary policy is gouging out the real economy at an escalating rate, which is collapsing manufacturing and other things. So what you have is the perfect playing out of LaRouche's triple curve collapse function. Now, so the whole system is coming down. When we see it disintegrating before our eyes, the question of deregulation the collapse, what happened in California and what happened with Enron is seen by a lot of people, and especially people who have listened to what LaRouche had to say and read what EIR has been saying, people we've been working with for a long time, see that deregulation has utterly failed. And there is a fight to try to reverse this tendency and to go with regulation in Congress. So that's a very powerful move forward. But at the same time, the bankers are throwing everything they can at it to try to make sure that nothing touches deregulation.
John, I read a Newswire that I think you were the author of a week or so ago, reviewing certain aspects of the state of affairs in the banking community. And I was astounded to see that there's a continuing increase in derivatives activity.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. I mean, these people are absolutely insane, and they're desperate. So, as you would think, if you were a sane person, you would think that when all of this paper starts to evaporate, that you would stay away from the paper. But, oh, no, that's not how it works. When your paper starts to evaporate, the trick is to buy more. The derivatives market is a perfect example of how it grows. It grew about 33% last year in the United States, according to the FDIC statistics. So overall, you can project that the global derivatives market is growing at, say, 33% a year right now, which means that if it was $300 trillion last year, it's now $400 trillion.
At the same time that the real economic output on a worldwide scale, what would you say that those figures are, say, global GDP or some equivalent?
It's about $42 trillion and falling, especially if you throw out the service aspect of it.
So the derivatives, the aggregates of these unregulated financial instruments is increasing by about 33% a year, and the real productive economy is on a decline of some rate, so that
yeah.
Curve is...
Yeah, you have somewhere probably north of $500 trillion of financial aggregates in total, debt and equities and derivatives and things like that. And that is rapidly growing while the physical economy, which pays the bills, is collapsing.
So about $11 in debt for every dollar in real wealth-generated activity, and that's probably even stretching it in some cases to say real wealth-generating activity.
Yeah, so there's no way this stuff can be paid. So if you're a big Wall Street bank or other player, how do you protect yourself against the fact that there's no way that your debt will ever be paid? Well, one way to do it is to buy credit derivatives. Credit derivatives are a form of credit insurance. So you have all of this worthless paper, and because you're concerned that it's worthless, you go out and buy credit derivatives to protect yourself. The credit derivatives pay off if the other paper defaults. So in order to protect yourself against the collapse of your worthless paper, you go out and you buy more worthless paper to insure it.
So it's kind of like somebody taking out a massive life insurance policy because they know they're going to commit suicide, and then they put the insurance policy in their own name with no other beneficiary. Something along those lines.
Yeah. Okay. It's insane.
Makes perfect sense to me.
Yes.
Now, in the midst of all this, with the Enron situation, the, quote, new LTCM with all of these potential cross-derivative obligations, like the LTCM crisis of 1998, what's Greenspan up to? What's he trying to do about this?
He's hyperventilating or hyperinflating. What Greenspan, the latest thing he did was to go to Congress, to the House Financial Services Committee and Judiciary Committee, and lean on them to push a derivatives netting bill through Congress this term. Now, the netting bill was originally part of the bankruptcy bill. And, you know, Congress realized it became obvious that more and more people were going bankrupt. And so the big financial players did what they normally do in such a case. They go to Congress and say, make it tougher to file bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of died out after 9/11, when a little bit more sanity began to creep into the discussion. So the bill got stalled. So Greenspan and Treasury Secretary O'Neill are pushing for this new bill, which would do just the derivatives netting for bankruptcies.
Explain to people what netting means.
Well, the simplest way to look at it is that if you and I are derivatives counterparties, and we each owe you $1 billion and you owe me $1 billion, that if I go bankrupt under the existing derivatives laws, my payments to you are frozen, but your payments to me are collectible and go to my creditors. So I declare bankruptcy. I don't have to pay you the billion. You have to pay me the billion.
Under the existing laws.
Under the existing laws. Now, if you figured that you have these giant derivatives banks, which are engaged in trillions of dollars of such trades, and they make a deal with one bank, and then they turn around and they make another deal with another bank, and the whole thing is so interlocked. If one of the big players goes under, and trillions of dollars, billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, however much it is, payments get frozen, then that can have a domino effect which would blow out the whole system. So what the bankruptcy bill is really designed to do is to tell the bankruptcy court, you have no jurisdiction over derivatives. You let the plunge protection team come in and figure this out, and they'll tell you how it works out.
So they're trying to basically avoid an LTCM type situation, which could be Enron, could be many other players with this massive expanding derivatives phenomenon where one big bankruptcy could tie up the entire system, as the relatively small LTCM case in 98. As I recall, even Greenspan admitted that that situation could have brought down the entire international financial system at the time.
Yes. And they responded with a wall of money to pump lots of money liquidity into the system. And it was that wall of money that, in many respects, made Enron possible, made the dramatic rise of Enron and some of these other pirates possible, because they were flooding the markets with money. But that policy doesn't work. That policy has collapsed. And they're still trying it because they don't know anything new. But the other side of this whole deregulation issue, and right now there's a real hard push to stop deregulation from coming up in any of the discussions, in any of the hearings.
The hearings on the Enron failure.
With the Wall Street Journal editorializing that Congress should concentrate on Enron as a crook. The decision has clearly been made to focus everything on Enron. Blame Enron, hang Enron, and don't let any other issues get in. And so what they're pushing is, if you, as one editorial put it, if you even bring up the issue of deregulation, you're giving Enron an out. Don't let Enron off the hook. Save deregulation.
Now, the rest of these pirate energy companies, there's quite a few of them that have popped up. I guess Dynegy was closely being followed in the media because they were considering buying this white elephant, Enron. Are any of these companies any different or any better, and is there any reason not to expect that they're going to go the same route as Enron and create an even bigger crisis?
Well, they're different in that, first, none of them were anywhere near as big. Mm-hmm. Enron was the 500-pound gorilla in the energy trading market. And is now, as events play out, it looks like it's being reduced to the organ grinder's monkey.
Ready for grinding.
you have others like Calpine and Mirant, which is a spinoff of Southern, the big Atlanta utility, who are energy traders and have, to a greater or lesser degree, more physical assets. But fundamentally, they're no different. They're just smaller. And these companies have taken a real beating since Enron filed for bankruptcy. The shares of all of these pirate companies are way down. And they give every indication of being... I mean, two things are driving them down. One is they're not viable. And after Enron, everybody's looking at their balance sheets, and the more you look at them, the faster they disappear. The other thing is that they're an assault on them to drive them down, because ultimately... the big banks are making a move to take over the energy trading business and to push these guys out of it. They want to buy them out at pennies on the dollar, like they're going to do with Enron. You know, Enron has now announced that it's going to sell its trading operation to some big bank, to be named later, whichever one is still alive
standing.
When the deal goes
last
through.
Bank standing.
But behind all of this, even, there's another layer of this, because... this is not, even if the big banks take it over and they start getting the income stream to replace the IPO market, which has collapsed, to replace the money from mergers and acquisitions, which they were receiving, which has collapsed, to replace a lot of the money from the stock sales and other things that have collapsed. So they get that income stream and they need it. They're desperate for it. But even then, it's not viable. And they're more broke than Enron because, you know, you have JP Morgan Chase, which has $24 trillion in derivatives. You know, any hiccup in the derivatives market, right, and they're gone.
Right. Just in the past few days, Lyndon LaRouche has reiterated his longstanding call for putting the entire international financial system, including these various energy companies, through bankruptcy reorganization. But he specified that he's particularly not talking about bailing out the banks, but is calling for a national industrial recovery program where the non-performing, unpayable debt of these entities would be set aside, and where the cash flows would not go into Wall Street, but would go into investment for real projects that would, for example, expand the actual energy-generating infrastructure of the country, rebuilding that infrastructure, expanding the kinds of industrial production that we'd need if we were going forward with projects like the Eurasian Land Bridge, things like that. Any thoughts or comments before we close out the show?
Well, I think that's the issue. It's LaRouche's redevelopment program versus the banker's post-crash scenario of grabbing your income stream. And the solution to solving these problems begins with a flea dip. You know, instead of listening to what all the fleas have to say, just give the dog a dip and be done with it. And then you can start rebuilding. And that's the only approach that will work.
Well, on that note, waiting for the flea dip to begin, I want to thank John for being with us here today. And this is a story that we'll be having a lot more to say about in future shows.
Now we'll switch to excerpts of the dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche at the Civil Rights Movement Solidarity, or BUSO, conference held in Germany this November 7th.
The only way you can transform a society from one that doesn't work, like the present European nations or the present U.S., is by educating the population to know. How can a population have the confidence to make revolutionary changes suddenly and in large numbers if they don't know what they're doing? They can continue to stumble into the ditch by following the habits they've acquired, habits expressed by the existing political parties, which might be called the rubbish dump of dead ideas. If you have a dead idea, you jump into one of these rubbish dumps and you are disposed of in due course. But if you want to be a part, a relevant part, of the conditions of life which are emerging, then you have to know what you're doing. To influence large numbers of people to make a fundamental change in the way they behave, they have to know what they're doing. And therefore, the issue is that. Let me just give one example of this from my own personal standpoint. Well, some years ago, now over 50 years ago, I made a certain series of scientific discoveries in the field of physical economy. These were made in the course of refuting the absurdity of the arguments for information theory by Norbert Wiener, and the arguments for systems analysis and artificial intelligence by John von Neumann, both of whom were acolytes in their childhood or youth of Bertrand Russell, and who represented a principle of pure evil. But these, later in the course of working through these discoveries I made, I found and turned again to Bernard Riemann and found out what kind of a conception you had to have. How do you organize such a set of ideas into a functioning economy? And therefore, the ideas of Riemann became an integral part of my own discoveries. Now, in this course of this, I came to understand how modern economies function. They function in terms of long waves, long cycles. Not the way Kondratiev described them for the Russians, but in other kind of long cycles. The cycles are, as Kondratiev suggested, largely technologically based. That is, when a society has adopted a certain kind of general technology, that technology, as it becomes the population becomes more proficient in it, as investment occurs, that wave of technology will tend to result in an increase in the productive powers of labor and other benefits. After a while, not making additional new discoveries will result that the same society which succeeded in that wave of technology will then go into an attritional period of decline. So we have these characteristic cycles in society, which are largely cycles of ideas. In physical science, they're cycles of physical ideas, or how to apply them. They're also cycles of the way people cooperate. If you educate people in a classical humanist mode in an educational system, then you will have a labor force which is able to think, which knows. Such a labor force can more rapidly assimilate new technologies, whereas a labor force which is trained, like a donkey, to pull the same load, given a different job to do, can't do it. So you have the cycles of culture as well as physical science and such. Thus, in analyzing economies, I always look at this question of axiomatics. What are the principles which cause an economy to behave the way it does? And you say the economy is behaving the way it does because the people in it, the form of government institutions, the form of laws, the form of accounting procedures and other customs, cause that society to behave in a certain way as if it were a very specific kind of geometry, in which nothing can happen that doesn't fit the assumptions, the definitions, axioms, and postulates of that geometry. And therefore, a society has a cyclical characteristic. The most typical cycle is that of one generation or two generations. If you look at the history of economy, the history of events, you find that the period from the age of birth to the age of about 25 years is a characteristic cycle in modern society, because it takes about 25 years to take a child and bring it to maturity as a professional in modern society. You will find that, for example, investments in infrastructure, benefits last for a quarter century to a half century. There are investments that take that long. Investment in an agricultural program by a farmer. He has to plan a crop program. He has to develop the crop program, which in vegetable crops is lower. If he has to develop cattle, like high-quality dairy cattle, it may take 25 years to build up a decent herd of high-quality dairy cattle. It's not done so easy. So it's an investment over a period of time whose fruit is harvested over a period of time and which is used up over a period of time. And so we think about five-year cycles, not so much, but 10, 20-year, 50-year cycles are the kind of cycles we experience in physical economy. And political economy tends to follow underneath the impact of physical economy. And the problem has been that in the post-war period, since 1945, the policies which the United States had intended to follow, had Roosevelt lived, were not carried out. Those policies meant the immediate elimination of colonialism, immediate. I mean, the French, the British, the Dutch, the Portuguese colonies would be instantly wiped from the map as colonies, and independent nations would stand where colonies had stood the moment before. The United States, which had built up a large war machine, industrial war machine, intended to convert that industrial war machine into a production machine for capital goods for the world at large, in conjunction with developing, as Roosevelt laid out in a famous meeting he had in Casablanca in 1942, to develop Africa, Asia, areas of colonialism to be developed as independent nations, and the United States, while helping Europe to recover from the combined effects of depression and war, would also devote a large part of its production to meeting the needs of these, so what we call today, developing nations. We didn't do that. But we developed a Bretton Woods system of modified form, which unfortunately was based on an artificial conflict between the Soviet system and the Anglo-American system. We lived under this mixture of conflict, and a fairly good economic system for Western Europe, Japan, the United States, the Americas, for a period up until the middle of the 1960s. Then, shortly after the death of Kennedy, the assassination of Kennedy, was torn down. It was signaled by the ouster of Erhard here in Germany, which was the turning point downward for the German economy. The attempt to ruin de Gaulle, the same period, which was a downturn for the French economy. You'll find that most of the benefits in Germany that are being taken away today were those which were built up and set into motion as part of the post-war economic recovery from 1945 to the middle of the 1960s. You find the same thing in France, in which France is living on the fag end of the exhaustion of what Charles de Gaulle, as president, contributed to the development of France, essentially. The same thing is true around the world. The United States, Western Europe, Japan, and most of the Americas were increased their productivity, improved their standard of living, improved the conditions of life consistently over a period of about that period, from 1945 to 1964-65. That was a cycle. Then with the changes that came, coinciding with the war in Vietnam, there were radical changes in culture, in politics, and in economics. And from 1965 on, Europe and the United States willfully began to destroy its own economy, its own productive capability.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.